Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
And I'm Ben Bolin.
And we've got a topic that I think you are going to be especially excited about today.
Oh, you know it, brother.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, we've been around a long time, right? We've been doing this. We were just talking off air. We've been doing this for, what, 5 years now? Approaching six?
Yeah.
And long-time listeners, even short-time listeners, will probably know that you drive a Monte Carlo.
I do, and it's not the first Monte Carlo I've driven. Now, we've talked about this kind of stuff before. We get some great emails and great Facebook messages and tweets from people who rightly give me a little bit of guff about how much I like this car. Now, I want to say from the offset here that we're finally addressing the Monte Carlo, and one of the things that we need to establish is, you guys, I know it's not the best car. I just like it because it's mine, and I don't have to make car payments.
So you're going to be very upfront about everything that's kind of gone wrong with it and things that have gone right with it as well.
Sure.
But it's not... Your car is not the focus of today's program. It's the Monte Carlo in general. From the very beginning. We're going to go back to the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about, you know, from the very, very start all the way through the very, very end. So, you know, that kind of comes along the way, though, as, you know, part of the redesign, the major redesign, mm-hmm. is the style of Monte Carlo that you have. Now, what do you have right now?
Right now, I have a sixth generation, a 2004.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, I had a 97.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Okay, so you've got, not a multi-generational, multi-generational Monte Carlo owner, right?
Yeah, and part of it is that it just worked out for me, and as we'll see, there's some very valid criticisms, often pertaining to the Lumina about Monte Carlos of that generation.
Do they hurt a little bit, Ben?
Do they hurt?
does it hurt just a little bit when some people say things like that?
Oh, it doesn't hurt my pocketbook, and that's the part that I'm, you know, that's the part that I'm more persuaded about. But we are going to probably need to make this a two-part episode because we have so much information. I guess we should start at the beginning because one of the primary questions people will ask about the Monte Carlo or about any car when we do an origin story just about a type of car mm-hmm. is why?
Why? Why is it? Why was it a popular car? Why was it? Why was it so so loved by the American public?
Mm-hmm.
That's maybe the real question.
Yeah. Why? What made this car, which again is not especially extraordinary, what made this car so popular?
Well, before we dig into the whole history of the car, like starting in the late 60s and everything, I just want to tell you kind of why I feel that we need to give it some context, I guess, to explain why people really fell in love with the Monte Carlo. And there were several good reasons, and there's probably about, I'm going to say maybe six or seven here on this quick list that I want to read. And you just have to remember that, you know, anybody who was looking for a new car buyer who was looking for something that had style, something that had distinction, something that was unusual, and Monte Carlo was all that, you know, at the time, they had a few choices. And I'll tell you what the marketplace was like early on. And pretty much throughout the 1980s, I'll say, 1970s, 1980s. But right at the very beginning, you know, of course, they had the choice between there's the Chevy Camaro or the Pontiac Firebird,
mm-hmm.
the Trans Am. They were kind of like they're like less practical. They were more sports car type vehicles, right? So
yeah.
There was also the Corvette and there was the Datsun Z car. Now, the Corvette and the Z car were both expensive. And, of course, they were kind of impractical sports cars for the typical buyer, I would say.
Right.
There was also the Pinto-based Mustang II and then the Oldsmobile 442, which the article that I read kind of put them into what they called pseudo-performance models. Now, I know that anybody with a 442 is going to say, wait a minute, or anybody with the Mustang II that's going to have, you know, they had the V8,
mm-hmm.
The great big V8 one
right.
I'm talking about. They're going to say those were really performance models, but again, they called them pseudo performance models. There were pickup trucks. There was like the Ford Bronco, which is kind of like an early SUV. Chevy offered the El Camino, and then of course Ford with the Ranchero. There were also high end imports, which is
it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's really no, you know, contest there. I mean, those are the high-end, high-dollar sports cars that really, even at the time, no one could afford. They're expensive then, they're expensive now. That's still the way it is.
It's a completely different category.
And then there are also kind of low-end imports, which were not really stylish at all. Because today, low-end imports, some of them are really nice, and,
sure.
and you can get by in those. But at the time, they were really cheaply made if you were buying a low-end vehicle, mm-hmm. not one of the top-end vehicles that we're talking about. So you can see that, you know, in that type of marketplace, the kind of car that we're going to describe for you today, the Monte Carlo, that was a really good choice. It was a solid choice for the American car buying public. Someone who wanted a two-door, long front end, great big mm-hmm. V8 engine, mm-hmm. Just that classic American coupe design.
Right, and they wanted it a little bit nicer than some of the other coupe offerings available. Mm-hmm. They wanted, essentially, a luxury coupe, or as someone might say a little bit less diplomatically, they wanted something that looked and felt more expensive than it actually was.
Ah, that's a good way to put it, Ben, because they were in direct competition with the Ford Thunderbird,
mm-hmm.
and the Thunderbird was a luxury coupe, right? I mean, that's another personal car. See, this is the weirdness about this. Chevrolet called the Monte Carlo and this is a strange term, but they called it the personal luxury car.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a coupe, and of course, it was a closed body, fixed roof. You know, at least two seats, but it had more. It had the back seat, of course.
Right.
Two doors. There was no B pillar, so, you know, when you rolled down the windows, it looked like it was wide open from, you know, A pillar to C pillar.
Yeah.
That's kind of the classic styling cues of the coupe, and that's changed along the way. I mean, they've even started now talking about, this is really weird, but four-door coupes is what they're talking about. I don't see it, but.
Yeah.
It goes so far away from the classic coupe theory. That I don't buy it.
I would say it directly contradicts the mm-hmm. nature of a coupe, but that might be a story for another day, because we do know that Chevy, when they were thinking about what kind of car they should make for the marketplace, the reason that the Monte Carlo was a clever choice is because it did fill a gap. There were people waiting to buy a car that would be somewhere in this area, both conceptually and financially, but they had a history that they had to work against, because Chevy was lagging, man. Chevy was not keeping up with the competition.
Yeah, you know what? They've had a direct competition with – they're in direct competition with Ford, as I mentioned a few times. And
mm-hmm.
can I just before – I want to get to that, but just before that, I want to stress this Thunderbird competition.
Oh, yeah, we need to.
Because, Ford coined the term personal car, I believe it was, right?
With the launch of the Thunderbird, the two-seat in 55.
Yeah,
right?
That's right. So it goes way back to 55. So we're talking a good solid 15 years before the Monte Carlo was going to come out.
Right, in 1970.
So what they did was they played on that, and they had this, they called it the personal luxury car instead of just the personal car.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of differences in this thing, in that, you know, the Ford was geared more towards a luxury vehicle, to begin with. I mean, you can just take a look at the early Ford Thunderbirds, and I'll tell you, they're definitely, they've got a lot of luxury styling cues in them. I don't know if they're really a luxury car or not, because, you know, the two-seater, that's more of a sports car to me. But later, the Thunderbird kind of grew up, and it became like this, you know, the square bird designs in the
mm-hmm.
mid-60s, and then later it became this great big, touring coupes, I guess, maybe is what you could call it.
Grew a backseat, too.
Yeah, it grew a great big backseat as well. And, the Thunderbird and Chevrolet, so Ford and Chevy were kind of in this back and forth. And I've got kind of a decent example about this. And the thing is that Ford was seeming to be ahead all the time with Chevrolet. And Chevrolet was in the position to react a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that you had the Ford Ranchero from 1957. Well, in about 2 years, then comes the Chevy El Camino. And then I think they mentioned the Ford Fairlane, which I'm not exactly sure what the direct response from Chevy was versus that. But there's about a 2 year lag on that. I'm thinking maybe the Bel Air, something like that, or the Biscayne.
Maybe. I think that's fair. I would probably go with the Bel Air, actually.
Maybe. So one of those two. So the Bel Air, the Biscayne. The Mustang, think about that. In 1964 and a half, that's when Ford came out with Mustang.
Mm-hmm.
It was 1966 when Chevrolet came out with its Camaro. So there's like this 2 year lag. Well, when Thunderbird came around in 1955, there was really very little response from Chevrolet. Although I do want to say this, though, it's kind of the switcheroo on this one, because, you know, Chevrolet had the Corvette.
Right.
In 1953.
Mm-hmm.
And then I believe that the Thunderbird was a response to the Corvette. And then people were looking for people to respond to the Thunderbird once again. So they're kind of looking for Chevrolet for like the third move. And it was a long time coming. And that's when all this started to happen with like the Pontiac Grand Prix and the Buick Riviera of the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those cars, they have a little bit to do with the Monte Carlo as well.
Yeah, and I think this is, I think that's a really good point that you brought up. I'm glad that you said this because we can't really take the Corvette out of the equation here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And when we talk about the first Monte Carlo coming out, which doesn't happen again, as we said, until 1970, it's important to remember that the Thunderbird was at this point in its sixth generation. So people waiting on that third move have been waiting for a long time. But the Monte Carlo also had a lot of influence from these makes we mentioned earlier.
Exactly. And you know what? The thing is that in the mid-60s, coupes were extremely popular. In fact, that was the most popular brand or type of vehicle, rather, not brand, but type. And as a matter of fact, Chevy had the most popular coupe of the time. It had the Impala Sport Coupe,
mm-hmm.
which people just loved. They went crazy for that. But in the mid-60s, these two-door hardtops were really, really popular in America. And they were even popular as family cars, which a lot of people wouldn't guess that, you know, a two-door, bigger car with a back seat, but still
right.
two-door. That was a very, very popular family car in the mid-60s. And by 1967, just because of the popularity of this type of vehicle, General Motors, you know how big General Motors was. They had
huge,
all kinds of divisions and makes and models. Well, they had Buick and Oldsmobile and Pontiac and Cadillac, and they all had these stylish coupes going on. So they had the great styling. And, you know, as I mentioned, the Chevy Impala Sport Coupe was the most popular of them.
Right.
But they also had the Camaro and the Corvette. But those were kind of different. They had a different audience, I guess. They had the Chevelle SS. They had vehicles like that
yeah.
were more for the super sports group, the people that wanted to do a little bit of maybe road racing.
Right. Performance over parenting.
Exactly.
How about that?
Exactly. that's probably a good way to put it, Ben. All right. So we kind of got the stage set for the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And this is really when things start to come about for the Monte Carlo, because Monte Carlo won't debut until 1970. And it's the mid-60s, I'm going to say like 1967, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when the Pontiac Grand Prix is up for a redesign. Now, remember, the Pontiac Grand Prix has been around since 1962.
Right.
And it'll hang around until 2008, if you want to know the truth.
I mean, yeah, spoiler alert.
Well, until, you know, Pontiac goes away, really.
Right.
So 1967, they're up for this redesign, and mm-hmm. guess who's involved in this, Ben? I think you know.
Are we talking about Bunky?
Well, Bunky's one.
Bunky's one.
Pete Estes, of course. And then there's another big name.
Oh, I'm missing it.
That's okay.
Okay.
We were talking about it off air, so I'm not sure if you knew it or not.
Mays.
No, that could be one, but I was thinking.
I'm just naming. Oh, I know. Dave Hollis.
Dave Hollis is one also.
I'm missing everyone.
You know what? I'm glad you said all those names because they're all important, but the big one that I was thinking of was John DeLorean.
Oh,
and
how did I miss that?
Well, you're talking about it. I thought
we were going to get to it. You're right.
I surprised you. I shouldn't have done it. But,
no.
But John DeLorean was involved in this, and really in a roundabout way early on. But later it'll come into, you know, he'll have more importance later in the story. But.
Right. So so John DeLorean, people will recognize him if you are at all familiar with the car DeLorean. He was the heart and soul of that ill-fated car. I think it's fair to call it ill-fated, mm-hmm. or at least his company. And at the time, he's the general manager of Pontiac. And the Grand Prix redesign comes about in part because John DeLorean is really considering cutting it entirely.
Yeah, he wants to get rid of the Grand Prix, which, you know, it's at the time it's a new car and it's not really struggling, but it's not doing fantastic. And, you know, later, I mean, Grand Prix was one of those cars that seems like everywhere you look, there's a Grand Prix on the road.
Right. Especially in the, especially leading up to 2008. But,
yeah.
Well, one real quick, if it's okay, can I name some of those characters?
Of course.
That I mentioned,
mm-hmm.
or expand on them a bit. So Dave Halls, the group chief designer for Chevy, of course, he knows about Thunderbirds. He's clocked the popularity of coupes. So they know that they have to do something. They're trying these different things. The other guy I named, Bunky, I don't think it's fair to say that I know him well enough to go by his nickname. So let's give him the full man. Seaman Bunky Knudsen, S-E-M-O-N. He was the general manager at the time, and he was already rejecting some car ideas on the idea that Chevy had too many offerings on the market.
Yeah, something like, how many did they have? They had over a dozen cars or something like that. I've got a note here in just a minute that I'll find that, I promise, somewhere along the way.
Yeah, and they're not all big hits.
You know what? I'm sorry, Ben. They had over two dozen models.
Oh, goodness.
Chevrolet had two dozen models of cars. So within Chevrolet, you could find more than 24 different vehicles that on your Chevrolet dealer's lot in different makes, models. Different models, not different
right,
makes.
Right, models.
So of course, they're all different, same make. But
yeah.
Imagine that. Now then combine that with, you know, other brands that they own, like Buick and Oldsmobile and Pontiac and mm-hmm. Cadillac mm-hmm. and all those. And just imagine how difficult it is to run a giant corporation that has that many vehicles out there. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that they were spacing themselves too thin.
And that's one thing that comes up almost in any business reorganization, is the idea of whether we should diversify or whether we should concentrate.
Well, see, then one group, one type of car then starts to cannibalize the sales of the other vehicles.
Exactly.
That's very, very close and maybe a little bit less expensive. So you've got fewer options on one vehicle and the other one has more options. Mm-hmm. Maybe you'll find that a lot of people are going to go with the fewer options, and then the other one that's maybe a little bit pricier is going to have to go away because, you know, sales are just dropping off.
So. Which is the perfect setup in a way to take us back to the Grand Prix and the Monte Carlo.
Yeah, well, here's what's going on. So there's this redesign, and John DeLorean's involved with it. Remember, he wants to get rid of the Grand Prix to begin with, but, you know, it's coming up for this redesign. And DeLorean says, well, you know, I genuinely like the design of the Pontiac Grand Prix for 1969, but it's going to be way too expensive for the Pontiac division to handle it itself. Now, remember, Chevrolet is like the flagship mark for General Motors.
Right.
And they're the ones with the deep pockets. They're the ones with all the money.
Yeah.
Now, Pontiac is there as well. They're okay. They're doing all right. They've got, you know, a lot of money to spend, but not quite as much as Chevrolet. So DeLorean says, let's work on a deal.
Ah, yes. And he talks to his buddy there, Pete Estes, dynamic general manager there, I think at Pontiac, right?
Correct.
And there's a little bit of historical, I guess, conversation, not quite a debate, about the nature of Estes and DeLorean's relationship. Mm-hmm. We know that I'm going to call them friendly rivals, Scott. How about that?
That's good enough.
They were likely friendly rivals. And so Estes and DeLorean strike a deal, and they're going to work on these projects together.
I think Estes may have been with Chevrolet. I'm going to have to double check on
that. Okay, wait. Let me check.
I believe DeLorean was with Pontiac at the time. Estes was with Chevrolet, I think. And so the way that they're working out this deal is that DeLorean says, we're going to share these ramp up costs. We're going to split the price with Chevrolet. So Pontiac and Chevrolet are going to share the mm-hmm. price of this one vehicle to be made because they like the lines of it. They thought it was a really good design. Everything's going to work out just fine. But they're going to have a 1-year exclusive deal for Pontiac because Pontiac was the one kind of calling the shots in this deal.
Oh, and yes, you were correct, Scott. That was my error. Pete Estes had been working as dynamic general manager Pontiac, but he was so good that when he made Pontiac number 3 in the industry, he got promoted.
And then here's a little secret that in 1969, early 1969, John DeLorean then moves over to head up the Chevrolet division, so he's going to be in charge of Estes.
Yeah.
So that's the way that all works out. But it's all within just a matter of months, really.
But at the time, you were correct. At the time, DeLorean is Pontiac, and Estes is promoted out of Pontiac.
And that's the way the deal worked.
That's how it worked.
That's because they were able to communicate and get this done for 1970. But remember, we said that there's a 1-year exclusive for Pontiac on that design. So they use it for the Grand Prix for the first part in 1969.
Yeah.
And they're going to allow the Chevrolet division to develop its own vehicle based on that design.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not going to be exactly the same car as they sometimes do today, you know, where they just add, you know, badging and things like
right.
that.
It's inspired by.
That's a good way to put it. Inspired by the 1969 Pontiac Grand Prix design is going to be this new vehicle, which they don't even really know what they're going to call it yet or anything like that.
No.
But this new vehicle that's going to be around for Chevrolet for 1970. All right, so they brought in this kind of hotshot young designer, and his name is Terry R. Henlein. And he's into the Chevrolet design studio, but he's not brand new. He's been there actually since 1961. Mm-hmm. So he's been kind of hanging around a while, but there's kind of an interesting little side note about him that I do want to tell you about.
Oh, yes, yes. I think I know where you're going with this. Do you want to go ahead and knock it out?
Yeah, maybe we should just say it. I mean, he was a finalist in what was called the Fisher Body Craftsman's Guild Model Car Contest in 1957 and 1958.
In high school, you guys.
In high school, yeah. So, you know, back in the late 50s, he was part of this whole group, and you may think, well, that's kind of a strange thing to say, is like he's a contest winner and he's designing a car.
Yeah.
It doesn't really work that way. He was a car designer, or rather automotive designer, that, caught the attention of designers early on, and they would often go in and recruit guys, you know, from high school ages and college, of course. You know, the GM was big into this for their art and style division or whatever they called it at the time.
And that's a good idea, because you'll still see some companies doing this sort of thing in engineering contests. Mm-hmm. The reason that the Guild Model Car Contest was such a big deal is that GM would help provide scholarships for the winners of this. And if you won, you got a free trip to Detroit to tour the studios and then meet the designers.
Which you got to remember, put yourself in that time. Like right now you're thinking, a free trip to Detroit. I don't know if I'd really even want that. But, and I'm not saying anything terrible about it. I'm just saying that, you know, it's still cool to go and visit those facilities. Because I've even done that in the last 2 years. I've been to Ford and toured their facilities. They're fantastic.
And everybody, Scott can say stuff like this because Scott has lived in Detroit.
For a long time, that's right. And you know what? Honestly, there's some really great, great places to visit around there. The Cranbrook Institute and GMI and all those places, they're fantastic. So don't get me wrong. I'm just playing around a little bit. But
so he officially joins in 61.
He did. And you know what? The thing about this Craftsman's Guild contest is that some of these other winners, like some of the guys that have won this in the past, one of the guys' names was Bob Cadoret, and I think he designed the 1956 Corvette. Virgil Exner Jr. came through that program. He was also a finalist. So, you know, the winners of that contest went on to good things. Not all of them, but, you know, a lot of them went on to bigger things in the automotive industry.
Yeah, about a third of them, right?
You're right. About a third of them ended up having, formidable positions in the automotive industry after winning something like that or being a finalist in that.
Because they were the cool kids. And Scott, when we're talking about the cool kids, you know what this makes me think of?
What's it make me think of? I would be willing to bet that Terry Henline was a snazzy dresser.
Yeah, I would bet so as well, because he is a designer, and as soon as he officially joins, you know, in 61, in 67, he's actively working in the Chevy studio under the guy we mentioned earlier, Dave Halls, and they start with the Cadillac Eldorado.
Yeah, and you know what? It makes perfect sense, I guess, when you look at the proportions of the original Monte Carlo.
Mm-hmm.
It does make sense when you look at it that way. But you have to look at the two cars side by side, and then you have to look at the Pontiac Grand Prix from 1969.
Yes.
Because that's the other car that they were basing this on as well. So, you know, there's all these different considerations to think about. And I tried to look at this, you know, via split screen, and there were just no good comparisons. So I had, you know, three different windows open on my computer trying to compare the three, the Cadillac Eldorado, the 69, Grand Prix, Pontiac Grand Prix, and then the 1970 Monte Carlo. And you can really see how all three of those cars kind of work together, you know, the styling cues within them.
Right.
So, you know, you use the roof line, a different car, the fenders of another one. And what he did was, he added these bulging fenders, these flared fenders, kind of like, and they mentioned the pre-war cars, which I thought was kind of strange, but I can kind of see it a little bit. I mean,
you can see it when you know what you're looking at. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think as long as they say that, you know, these are bulging fenders a lot like the pre-war cars, only shrunk down just a bit, like kind of tucked in.
Yeah.
And I can understand that. You can see that in the design. There's also single headlights, not the quad lights like other Chevrolets were using, like the Chevelle and other GM cars. And what they say about the, you remember the grill?
Oh, yeah. Inspired by Rolls Royce, right? Because the grill kind of juts out.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's a tougher one for me to grasp, I guess, but it's inspired by maybe the Rolls Royce. That's probably the best.
Based on a true story, as they say.
Yeah, I guess so. But, you know, overall, you know, he had the right idea. He took a bunch of different elements, he put them together, and you'd think that it sounds like this big hodgepodge mix.
Like you Frankenstein'd a car.
Exactly. But it turned out really well, and so well that they built a clay model that they presented to Pete Estes and Bill Mitchell. Remember Bill Mitchell from our Corvette stories?
Uh-huh.
He was the styling VP for GM. And they presented this clay model to them for formal approval. And both of them, Ben. Both of those two guys. I mean, that's a tough crowd. That's a Pete Estes and Bill Mitchell.
Yeah.
They both okayed it with no changes at all.
Which, just so you guys know, is amazing, and I'm not going to say it never happens, but I will say it virtually never happens.
It's a rare occurrence, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, it's a designer lottery. He won it the first time he bought a ticket,
and
essentially.
He's a young guy. I mean, he's a young designer, so this is looking good for his career, right?
Right, and some people, of course, weren't as into the design, right? They said maybe it was a little bit too reminiscent because of those bumpers, right?
Yeah, the fenders and the bumpers and everything. They said it was a little too retro in design. They thought it was calling back too many pre-war styling cues.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see too many pre-war styling cues in the early Monte Carlo design, but maybe I'm way off on that one. I don't know.
One thing we do need to talk about while we're talking about the design of the first gym Monte Carlo is that they did some things to differentiate it from the Chevelle, especially. And those things, the ones we see most noted are the sail panels and then these like deep set tail lights, right?
Yeah. And the front clip was totally different. So and the rear fenders, those were a little bit different. But I mean, all in all, I guess we need to say that, you know, the Chevelle and the Monte Carlo, they shared a lot of parts.
Yes, sir, they did. And that's something that we will see in future generations of Monte Carlos as well.
They called it a dressed up Chevelle, I think is what they called
it.
Sport-coated Chevelle.
Sport-coated Chevelle.
That's the way they put it. They said, because it's more of a luxury vehicle rather than a sports vehicle, they said, let's just say it's got a sport coat on. It's like it's dressed up for the evening, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And that was not always meant as a compliment, but there was a problem here with some of these things. One thing, the sail panels there, both on the Monte Carlo and the Grand Prix, they looked good, but they didn't actually help with driving. Like, they gave you bigger blind spots.
Mm-hmm. Sure, yeah. I mean, there was a limited sight availability in those things. I don't know. I guess sight lines is the way you'd say it.
Yeah.
You know, if the driver were to look over his right shoulder and try to look, you know, to whoever's in the passing lane next to them, or the lane next to them, either side, I guess, would have a little bit of a blind spot. And that was one of the critiques of this whole thing. And of course, you know, they mentioned that, you know, the styling wasn't always lauded by the press either. They said, you know what, that sport coated Chevelle comment, that was kind of an underhanded compliment. I mean, it was saying, well, you're just taking another car and you're just dressing it up a little bit and making it look that way.
Right.
You're also taking, you know, the dash and you're adding wood grain to it and trying to make that look like a luxury dash when we know it's the Chevelle dash underneath there.
And you and I have talked about this kind of thing before, because I resent the implication. Because the implication is that this is just a badging switch, essentially.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it's dressing up a lower brand, I suppose.
Right.
Or not necessarily a lower brand, but a different brand.
And so that leads to the implication that the company somehow is seeking to bilk people by charging them more for essentially the same product when it comes down to performance. But this is, in my opinion, incorrect. They're different enough.
All right. You know what? I want to tell you about, we're getting kind of near the end here, I think,
okay,
of part one.
Yeah.
But what I want to do is I want to say that there were just more than cosmetic differences between the Chevelle and the Monte Carlo.
Thank you.
And I can just list a couple of them for you here real quick, and then we can talk about price, or we can hold on to price for the next episode. I don't know how we'll do it. But
okay.
Monte Carlo and the Chevelle were mechanically similar, except that they had a base suspension that was a little bit stiffer for the Monte Carlo because it had extra weight. It had that long, long front end. Remember that? They called it heroically long front end.
It's a very long nose. It's a Pinocchio.
Yeah, it's very, very long. But that's part of the whole style of it. You know, it's that short back and long, long front end.
Smoother ride.
It had extra sound insulation, so it seemed like it was a smoother ride. It felt smoother because it's the driver perception, right?
Yeah, and we talk about this in our earlier podcast on what makes a luxury car. Mm-hmm. A huge part of it is how the ride is perceived.
Yeah, interior sound levels and decibel levels and things like that. Now, I mean, I'm sure in a 1970s car, it's still awful loud, but it was a lot quieter than the Chevelle would have been.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there were standard front disc brakes, which was an extra option on most Chevelles. I think some may have had it, but maybe the SS models. And then there was also kind of like a similar engine lineup for the Chevelle and the early Monte Carlo. So, you know, mechanically they shared a lot of different things. There were some differences, but again, it's just kind of a dressed up Chevelle, really.
Yeah, okay. All right, man. Okay.
You gonna buy that?
You know, you're not wrong.
Well, there's more to it than just that. I mean, we're just hitting the highlights.
Right. But you're right. Let's not get too bogged down in that. Let's end on the price tag. What do you say?
Yeah, let's do that because I've got some numbers that I've been really throwing them around a bit here, and I've even got some price comparisons between 2013 and 1970.
Perfect.
So I think we can wrap it up with this, and it's pretty interesting to see where they priced it because you'll find out just how fair they were about pricing these. All right, so. You got to keep all these things in consideration. That the starting price for the 1970 Chevy Monte Carlo was just $3,123.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's about $200 more than a similarly equipped Malibu hardtop was at the time, and the Malibu was another vehicle kind of like the Chevelle that similar in design. They all looked pretty close to each other. It's one of the two dozen cars in Chevrolet's line.
Right, and let's be fair. That $3,123 mm-hmm. is a no extras price. That is the base of base prices.
Exactly. Yeah, that was right down to the very bottom. So if you wanted to add things like an automatic transmission or power steering or
radio,
the price goes up to $3,600. Now that adds about $450 to the price.
So who wouldn't order a radio?
Well, I don't know, but they said that that was almost always ordered that way. So they almost always wanted an automatic trans because it had this luxury car feel. Power steering, of course, because it was a big car. And then radio, of course, you're going to want a radio in your car. I mean, not many people are going to delete that. Now, there's another vehicle that we haven't even started to talk about yet, but there's the SS454 model. And those, which we'll talk about in episode 2, I promise,
mm-hmm.
Fully loaded SS454 could cost somewhere around $5,500, which doesn't sound like a whole lot right now. But as you'll find out, that was still pretty steep even back then.
Do you have a translation for us?
I do. From 1970 to 2003. So let's see, the base price was $3,123. That equates to $18,798 in 2013. So about a $19,000 car. Right? Okay, so mm-hmm. fair enough. But when you bump that up to the $3,600 with the automatic trans, power steering, and radio, that $3,600 translates to just under $22,000.
Oh, okay.
So it steps it up quite a bit. And then we mentioned the SS454, the $5,500 vehicle. That's $33,000, Ben.
Well, that's
now,
a big ask.
It is, but you know what? When we compare this, and I'm gonna kind of let the cat out of the bag here.
All right.
All right, so first things first. Let's get back to the Ford Thunderbird. That started around $5,000. Now, remember we talked about Ford Thunderbird being the main competition.
Right.
It started around $5,000, which is about $30,000 today, and it usually sold for about $6,000 with all the add-ons and extras. So that's about $36,000. A little bit more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So, they were well under that. So they were outpacing them, on sales based on the dollar amounts. The Pontiac Grand Prix for 1970 was something like $4,000. So that was about a $24,000 car.
Wow.
In today's terms.
Mm-hmm.
And as you can imagine, being priced at $31,23, they were outselling the Pontiac Grand Prix. They were cannibalizing mm-hmm. some of the Pontiac sales on the Chevrolet side. So they were a little bit upset about that, but, because they're offering a similar car with different options, lower options, but still, the size and a lot of the features that people wanted.
And this goes back to one of our first statements at the beginning of this. Chevrolet had a wildly profitable thing on their hand. They have finally found a personal luxury car that was the cheapest you could buy.
Exactly. And you know what? This is a two-door coupe thing, and as we'll talk about next time in our next podcast, we're going to talk about the Camaro and how the Camaro eventually replaces the Monte Carlo in the lineup in 2010. Well, I can tell you that, based on numbers, the 2010 Chevrolet Camaro, this will show you how fair they priced it really when it came out. The LS or base price vehicle was $22,995, which is right in the ballpark of that similarly equipped 1970 Monte Carlo mm-hmm. with the radio and the trans and all that stuff, right? That was priced at right about $22,000. An SS model was $30,995 in 2010. That was the Camaro
yeah.
SS. If you recall, the 454 SS Monte Carlo was priced right at $33,105. So they're extremely, they're right on target for what they're pricing and replacing it with.
Yes.
In 2010.
And,
I know that's a lot to cover, man, but when you look at it all laid out in front of you, it becomes very clear what exactly happened here.
And now also, I think, especially for a lot of our younger listeners, it it's very important to hear how those prices translate to the modern day, least in my opinion.
Yeah, because when you look back at ads that say that, you know, this brand new car is $3,123, you don't realize that that's $19,000 in today's terms.
Right, because the first instinct is to say, well, I'm going to get four. But
or why didn't everybody buy one of these and just put it in the garage and leave it? Well, that's because it cost $20,000, that's why.
So before we head out for part one of our Monte Carlo podcast, I have some listener mail for you.
Sounds good.
Okay, Scott, a guy named Ben, who I promise is not me, wrote in with a suggestion for our show. He said, "Hi, Scott and Ben, I have a suggestion for a new show. I looked at your website and could not find any podcast on semi-trucks. My suggestion is you should do a catch-all podcast on semis, or maybe more specific, like one on Kenworth, Peterbilt, or an engine manufacturer like Detroit Diesel or Cummins, etc. Anyway, love the podcast. Keep up the good work."
Not a bad idea. And, you know, we've talked about, I know we've talked about semi-trucks in general. Like sometimes we've talked about the navigation systems and things like that that go along with them, and some of the troubles that truckers have with automobiles on the road. And, the braking systems and all that, you know, some of the new technology. But we've never focused on a brand, have we? Like
no,
Kenworth
we haven't.
Or Mack or any of those.
Which could be pretty interesting.
It could be if we had a whole show on Peterbilt or something like that. Yeah. That may be fun.
Well, listeners, let us know that if you agree with Ben from the internet who wrote to us. And in the meantime, we hope you enjoyed part one of our episode on Monte Carlos. Let's call this one the origin story.
Yeah, that's right. And we're going to get into some really good stuff for the next one, because we're going to bring it right up to present day.
Yes, stay tuned.
And there's NASCAR, and there's pace cars, and there's all kinds of stuff coming in the next one.
There's so much coming in the next one. Stay tuned. In the meantime, send us a line on Facebook. Drop us a tweet. We are CarStuffHSW on both of those. Visit our website, carstuffshow.com, and you can even send us an email directly. Our address is
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.